Case number 13-1033, Southwestern Power Administration et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Whitaker for the petitioners, Ms. Perry for the respondent.
May it please the Court. This case presents the question whether Congress made Section 215, first provision in the history of the Federal Power Act, authorized imposition of a monetary penalty on the federal government. There is no dispute that as to all of the other many provisions of the Federal Power Act that are applicable to federal entities, that Congress did not authorize the Commission to impose a monetary penalty on a federal agency, even while at the same time it did authorize imposition of monetary penalties when a private entity violates the very same provision. And that, I think, reflects...
So is your position, it was a little unclear from the briefs, that, I'm going to call it NERC, that's probably not the right pronunciation, isn't it? NERC?
I think that'll do, Your Honor.
All right. Can NERC impose a monetary penalty on a private party under your reading of the statute?
We have not disputed that NERC has authority in this proceeding to impose a monetary
penalty. Is that consistent with your overall interpretation of Section 215?
I think it is consistent, Your Honor, because, again, our position is that the federal government is not subject to Section 215E1.
Can NERC impose a non-monetary penalty against the government?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that NERC has the authority under Section 215E1 to impose a non-monetary penalty against the government. Again, our position is that subsection E of the statute is not applicable to the federal government. And to the extent that 215 authorizes regulation of the federal government, it does so in the only provision that mentions the federal government, which is in 215B1. 215B1 does mention the federal government, but there is no explicit cross-reference between B1 and E1.
Is there a sovereign immunity problem with the question that Judge Srinivasan asked? That is, there is a sovereign immunity problem, you argue, with respect to a penalty, monetary penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a sovereign immunity problem with a non-monetary penalty?
Yes, there is. I mean, sovereign immunity does apply to both monetary and non-monetary penalties, although, as it happens in this case, in B1, we do understand B1 to be, at a minimum, a statement that the Commission does indeed...
Well, hasn't the Supreme Court drawn a distinction between punitive monetary penalties and compliance penalties, and suggesting that it's the punitive one that raises the issue of sovereign immunity?
But both of them raise the issue, Your Honor. I think Your Honor's thinking of the DOE versus Ohio case.
Yes, I'm not just thinking of it. I'm looking at it. Yeah.
Right. Well, in DOE versus Ohio, I think there was the way that statute worked is that there was a clear statement with regard to the imposition of non-monetary remedies and indeed non-punitive monetary remedies that overcame the sovereign immunity presumption. It's not to say a clear statement didn't apply to both forms of relief.
So what would you say about coercive, I think they call them coercive penalties as opposed to coercive fines as opposed to punitive fines?
Well, in this case, I don't think that there is any authority to impose any kind of monetary penalty on the federal government. Again, the only source, as I understand it, in the statute.
Where does the authority come from? If it doesn't come from E, you say it comes from B, to impose non-monetary penalties against the government.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in B1, the phrase used in B1 is that FERC has the power to, quote, enforce compliance with the provision.
So if NERC says there's a violation and asks FERC to enforce compliance, then it's okay?
Well, I suppose NERC could do that, yes, with regard to the federal government, right?
How is that different than NERC issuing an order, you appealing to FERC, and FERC affirming the order?
Well, there is somewhat of a difference, Your Honor. I mean, the statute certainly does contemplate that NERC.
I see the difference with respect to monetary penalty because in one case the monetary penalty actually goes to NERC. I'm not sure I see it with respect to a non-monetary penalty.
Well, but even with regard to a non-monetary penalty, and the statute does recognize that penalties can include non-monetary penalties, mm-hmm. is that, I mean, if nothing happens and NERC imposes a monetary penalty, it goes into effect automatically after 31 days, whereas if NERC...
Well, you have the ability to appeal, right?
That's true.
So if nothing happens, it's your own fault, as they say.
That's true, but it's a difference. I mean, and more importantly, I mean, generally the way things work with NERC is that...
Sort of rhymes. Good. It's going to be a problem.
normally the way things work is that NERC is out there settling cases with private entities. I mean, and I suppose NERC has the stick of being able to.
Well, under your theory, is NERC completely out of the question and FERC has to make all these judgments totally by itself without reference to NERC with respect to the federal government, leaving aside the monetary penalty issue?
Not exactly, Your Honor. I mean, we do indeed as a matter of policy.
That's not the question I'm asking. I'm not asking what your discretion and policy is. I'm asking whether under the statute you think that FERC can't rely on NERC with respect to non-monetary compliance by the government?
That's right, with regard to mandatory non-monetary compliance. But, I think Your Honor asked about whether, quote, NERC is out of the picture.
Yeah,
as a practical matter, NERC is certainly not out of the picture because, as we did in this case with regard to what NERC required us to do with the alleged violations, we took action. We didn't ignore NERC and say, you found these violations and we're not going to do anything.
What if you
did?
What could NERC do?
I don't think NERC could do anything
about it. They can't go to FERC.
Why can't we get the non-monetary enforcement power for NERC against the federal government and not the monetary by acknowledging that there's an ambiguity in 215? 215B gives generally powers that include powers against the U.S. explicitly and includes power to enforce compliance. When we try to find out what enforcement is, we look at 215E. And we see there's no reference there to the United States. So why don't we read 215E powers under Chevron, where there's no sovereign immunity bar to permit non-monetary penalties against U.S. entities, but where there's a sovereign immunity problem and therefore a higher need for clarity, there isn't power. I'm not sure why that isn't the best way to read 215, so that there is power on the part of NERC to use non-sovereign immunity barred remedies and not to use monetary penalties as a shorthand.
It's a possible bar. I do think that the sovereign immunity canon applies both to monetary and non-monetary penalties. But I mean, I think the reason why that doesn't quite work is the only provision of the statute that explicitly mentions the federal government speaks of the commission's power to do certain things. And that language that gives that authority in B1 stands in marked contrast to E1.
Well, what do you say about 201? That says, notwithstanding subsection F, which is the subsection that excludes the federal government, 824O shall apply to the entities described in such provisions for purposes of implying the enforcement authorities of this chapter.
Well, first of all, that wouldn't get you over the sovereign immunity canon, which I take it is a clear statement rule that operates separately.
Why wouldn't it? It says notwithstanding. Well, the part F says, unless such provision makes specific references to the United States, they don't apply. But B makes a specific reference.
That doesn't work, Your Honor, for a couple reasons. First, B2, all B2 is doing is basically pointing out provisions that, once you read them, contain more specific references to the federal government.
That's true, but...
Go ahead.
It goes on to say, as the Chief Judge quoted earlier, it does do that. It does do that. But it also says, and for purposes of applying the enforcement authorities of this chapter with respect to such provisions.
Well, we know that B2 is not an independently waiving immunity because Congress, in all those provisions that are cited, go on to include specific references to various entities that waive sovereign immunity. But more importantly, I mean, certain provisions in B2 that are cited there concededly do not apply to the federal government. And I'd point, Your Honor, in particular to 824ID, so 824I is mentioned without differentiation in B2.
Can And yet, can you give us the page?
Sure, yeah. This is, so B2 is...
Is it A16?
A18.
Yeah, so, I mean, we know...
A5, I thought, right? The appendix to your brief, page 5?
Appendix to your brief.
We're all looking at a different thing.
I was looking in the statutory appendix, actually.
Right.
Applicability...
When you say B2, you mean 824 B2?
824 B2, yes. AKA 201.
And you're cross-referencing to 824I, right?
Oh, I see.
Yes, so 824I is at A11. And so 824I is mentioned without differentiation in B2 as a provision, as a provision that to which the 824F clear statement rule doesn't apply. And yet we see in D that, you know, the commission may issue certain orders on its own motion. No such order may be issued upon the commission's own motion with respect to federal power marketing agency. So again, all B2 tells you to do is read on in the various provisions that are mentioned and look at them to determine the extent to which they apply to the federal government. And if we do that with regard to 215, the only provision that is mentioning the federal government within the context of 215 is B1. And I think that the structure of B1 is, and E, the statute we have here, is remarkably similar to the structure of the statute the Supreme Court considered in DOE versus Ohio. There, as here, the court was faced with enforcement provisions, citizen suit provision that provided, as you mentioned, Judge Garland, certain remedies against the United States, and it, quote, included the United States within that provision. And yet, that provision in turn cross-referenced a separate provision that authorized punitive civil monetary penalties. And notwithstanding that explicit cross-reference, the court held that because the punitive monetary penalties provision included applied to persons, which is a term not defined to include the United States.
So that's why I was wondering, why is that your last argument rather than your first argument? Why isn't 316A all you need? 316A describes when civil penalties are allowed. They're allowed against persons. The United States is not defined as a person. So for purposes of this case, isn't that enough to resolve the sovereign immunity question? And that's it.
Well, that's certainly our view of the statute, Your Honor.
If that is, why didn't you lead with it rather than only come into it at this far into the argument? Am I missing? I would hate to rely on an argument you don't actually think is very strong.
That litigation judgment? I don't know, Your Honor. But I do think that we do certainly advance that argument. And I mean, that argument is particularly salient if you look at the structure of 215E itself, which all 215E speaks about are, quote, penalties.
But I think maybe the reason you didn't lead with it is because 215E is dealing with the specific context of reliability standards. 316A deals with civil money penalties writ large. And so if you found in 215E a specific indication that the United States was supposed to be subject to the penalties
right.
in 215E with respect to reliability standards, I don't think anybody would reach right. the conclusion that 316A trumps that.
But if you read 215 without any preconceived notion about whether it does indeed mention the United States, I think it reinforces the idea that the premise of Your Honor's question is incorrect, namely that 215E does not contain specific language that mentions federal government entities. Again, E talks of user, that uses the undefined term, user, owner, or operator, which stands in sharp contrast to virtually every other instance in the Federal Power Act when Congress imposed duties and obligations on the federal government. In almost all of the other instances, it does so by defining the regulated entities to include the United States, which section...
What seems a little difficult about that line of argument to me is that what B1 seems to be doing is it's saying the United States and a bunch of other folks are subject to the jurisdiction of the commission for a few purposes. One is to ensure that you comply with reliability standards. That's easy. Nobody disputes that. Then it talks about approving reliability standards and enforcing compliance. And when you ask what does approving reliability standards and enforcing compliance mean, you look to E. And if you're not in E at all, then I'm not quite sure I follow why you're acquiescing in the notion that you're subject to anything. Because what B seems to say is you look to E to figure out the extent to which these entities are subject to enforcement. Your position is E doesn't cover us at all.
Well, no, but I think at least an equally plausible way to understand the statute, Your Honor, is that B-1 is indeed an independent grant of enforcement authority to the commission. I mean, the language in B-1, enforcing compliance, is the same language that Congress used in 825M to define the scope of the commission's authority to seek injunctive relief to enforce orders in district court.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not unusual for Congress to use that language in this specific context to define certain enforcement authority that the commission possesses. So I think that's at least a, that at least as equally plausible as the commission's understanding that, that E somehow is this independent source of authority. And it, but if, and if that's really what E is doing, it's a pretty odd way for Congress to have done it. I mean, E in essence is largely superfluous with B-1 because B-1 does look like it is providing some independent source of enforcement authority. So it's really hard to see why Congress would have included both provisions of the statute if that really were correct. But I mean, Your Honor's point with regard to 316A, I think that reflects an important principle in the Federal Power Act that should inform the broader context of the Court's consideration of this question, and that is that 316A, by expressly exempting the federal government as among the entities that are subject to penalties, reflects the principle that governments are different when it comes to regulating entities under the Federal Power Act. And the same duties and obligations that apply to the federal government are not necessarily needed when it comes to public-minded federal entities, which are not profit-maximizing entities, are not profit-maximizing entities and do act differently than private entities.
316A was in the statute before 215 was added, is that right?
It certainly was, Your Honor.
So what I can think of two opposite things to take from that. What do we take from that? It was worded slightly differently. And in fact, the way it was worded before was it limited civil penalties to sections 211, 212, 213,
right,
and 214. And
right,
I take it that later when 215 was added, it added 215.
Right.
What do we take from, what should we take from the order in which these provisions were? I mean, well, I guess one way to take it is this was the limitation on all enforcement. 215 changed that. The alternative way to read it is this is the limitation on enforcement. And when 215 was added, it was with the under Congress's understanding that there was limitation on monetary.
Well, I think the changes only underscore that section Congress did not consider Section 316 entirely independent of 215. And in the same legislation in which it added 215, Congress expanded the scope of Section 316A to authorize enforcement for any provision of Part 2, of which Section 215 is a part. It also added a cap on the imposition of monetary damages liability of $1 million per day. And if Congress had really thought that Section 215E is, quote, a separate grant penalty authority, as the Commission thinks now, thought something different in 2006, it thinks that now. But it's really hard to see why Congress would have bothered to make Section 316A applicable to enforce Section 215.
So under 316A, does 316A apply to an ERO? Because 316A speaks in terms of a commission.
No, it doesn't apply to.
So 215E1, which speaks to an ERO, that doesn't have anything to do with 316A.
Well, I think it's a fair point, Your Honor. I mean, look, I do think that what Section 215E is doing is making clear that, yes, NERC has some enforcement authority in this field. So to this extent, I think the Commission is right. I mean, if you had specific terms
right
in 215E, you know, that might, you know, you'd have to harmonize that with 316A. And with regard to NERC's enforcement authority, clearly NERC has some enforcement authority in this field, and Section 316A does not.
Right, 316A doesn't have anything to do with
right,
it because it only comes about by virtue of 215E1.
But what E does not speak to explicitly, with the explicitness needed to waive immunity, is the entities that are subject to penalty. It uses an undefined term, whereas 316A, in sharp contrast, does define the term person, which everyone agrees in this case does not include the United States. So as to that, I think it's at least plausible to think that that actually does govern. And the only response the Commission has to this point, and it says it again and again, is this question-begging argument that, well, if you assume that we win under 215E, then 316A is irrelevant. But if we think about how 316A should inform our consideration of whether 215E does specifically mention the federal government. It certainly reinforces the inference that it does not do so with the clarity, specificity, and the way that it needs.
Further questions?
Sorry, time is up.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lona Perry for the Commission. I'd like to start, I suppose, with Section 316A. It was the Commission's position that Section 316A is an independent grant of penalty authority that doesn't limit the penalty authority that is granted by virtue of 215E to the Commission, and by virtue of 215 as a whole to the Commission, which is properly read as a whole. 316A has to do with...
So is it the Commission's position that under 215, a civil penalty of more than $1 million could be imposed?
Your Honor, it's the Commission's position that the limitations on a 215E penalty are the ones that are provided in 215E6. And there isn't a specific penalty cap that's provided.
So is the answer yes, it could be $10 million.
Well, not, Your Honor, if it doesn't meet the limitations that are included in
E6. Say it does meet those limitations. Really bad. It's a really bad violation. They do it over and over again. Could it be $10 million?
The Commission has interpreted the $1 million limit to apply to 215 violations.
As a matter of its discretion and policy, or because B imposes a limit?
It interpreted the statute, Your Honor, because there was no cap provided in 215. In Order 672, the Commission determined that an appropriate cap would be
$1 million. Yes, that's what I'm asking. Is this the Commission's view of what's appropriate or the Commission's view of what it must do? Could it decide that $10 million is appropriate?
It's an interesting question, I think,
that's
Your
why
Honor.
I asked.
It's an interesting question, I think, Your Honor, if you are talking about an issue. I mean, the thing you have to remember is that 316A only applies to persons
and to
the Commission imposing a penalty on a person. And if under 215 you were a person upon whom the Commission was imposing a penalty, I think it would be an interesting question whether you could complain if the Commission imposed a penalty on you that was more than $1 million. But
when you say it's an interesting question, you mean that it's correct, that the Commission could not do that. Is that what you mean by an interesting question?
Well,
I'm asking, I need an answer to this question. Could the Commission impose, certainly a user, owner, and operator of a bulk power system is also a person, correct?
It can be a person.
Well,
but it also cannot be a person.
In what way could it not be a person?
Oh, Your Honor, I mean, that's what we're here.
I'm assuming it's a private operator.
Right. It has to be either an individual or a corporation.
Yes. So if they are an individual or a corporation, could a $10 million civil penalty be imposed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Yeah. The Commission has not directly spoken to
right.
this
so
issue.
So if that's
so
true,
I,
that's
but
only
I don't
because
so.
316AB puts a limit on it. So why doesn't it also put a limit with respect to persons? That is, only persons can get civil penalties. Why isn't that an equally, at least valid interpretation, given the Supreme Court's instruction to us that where there's a sovereign immunity problem, the waiver must be unequivocal?
Your Honor, because 316A, the thing you have to remember about 316A is that it is an affirmative grant of enforcement authority. What it says is, Commission, if there is a person who violates one of the provisions of Part 2 of the Power Act, the Commission can issue a penalty against them up to $1 million. What it does not say is that Congress can nowhere else in this statute confer any penalty authority on anybody else.
You just told me that its clause with respect to the $1 million cap is imposed elsewhere. Let me put it this way. Do you think NERC could impose a penalty of more than $1 million?
I do believe that 316A does not apply to NERC. By its terms, it only applies to the Commission and it only applies to persons.
So your view is that the Commission, an agency of the United States, can only impose a $1 million penalty. But NERC, which is a private entity, could impose $1 billion entity. Is that right?
Your Honor, NERC is not limited at all by 316A.
And then the commission can affirm the $1 billion because the NERC penalty is subject to review by the commission.
That's right, Your Honor.
Does that, that seem like a reasonable reading of the statute under a circumstance where we have to look for complete clarity with respect to the United States?
It does, Your Honor, because it's 316A is an independent grant of authority,
well,
and it has nothing to do.
That's what we're trying to decide. That's not the assumption. That's got to be the what we have to decide whether it's separate.
Well, it's separate, Your Honor, obviously in the sense that it doesn't say anything about penalties that are conferred by the Electric Reliability Organization. And the Electric Reliability Organization under 215 clearly has authority to award penalties.
Does it have authority to award monetary penalties? Is the word monetary penalties anywhere in 215?
The word monetary is not in 215, but the commission found, as the commission found, the word penalty has never been understood not to include monetary penalties.
I'll refer you to the Supreme Court opinion that I was just discussing with opposing counsel, which goes to the question of what the meaning of sanction was, said that sanction did not include punitive fines, and define and reference Black's Law Dictionary defining sanction as a penalty. And yet the court said that given the sovereign immunity concerns here, we're not going to allow punitive, we're not going to interpret sanction to include punitive fines. So there is an example, it just happens to be the Supreme Court of the United States, which says penalty doesn't always include a monetary penalty of the kind we're including here.
Your Honor, I would direct your attention. I mean, I understand that that was the interpretation of the term sanctions that it was looking at earlier on in the decision. Mm-hmm. But I would direct your attention, for example, to page 626 when they were interpreting the phrase civil penalties arising under federal law. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said that just reading that phrase alone suggests that it includes punitive along with coercive fines.
That was after they decided it didn't apply to the government, though, right?
Ultimately decided that, but they looked at that and they said, just looking at that phrase, it suggests that it applies to punitive as well as coercive fines. And then they went on to determine that it didn't apply to because of the preceding language apply to punitive fines in that instance. But their point was that phrase in the abstract punitive fines.
It's ambiguous, is what. You know, it could or it could not. What do you do with, just one last question before I stop asking you questions. On Part C in 815 and 215, Part C to Big C, it talks of, this has to do with certification. It says, provide fair and impartial procedures for enforcement of reliability standards through the imposition of penalties in accordance with subsection E of this section. And then in parentheses says, including limitations on activities, functions, or operations, or other appropriate sanctions. But it does not mention, doesn't mention monetary. Isn't that surprising that in an entire section about penalties, there's not a single reference to monetary penalties, even when it then goes, the section does discuss several other kinds of penalties?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say so. I would say actually it's the opposite, which is what the commission suggested, which is that penalties are commonly understood to be monetary penalties. And the purpose of including, and the Supreme Court said this in West versus Gibson, anytime you see including, it doesn't mean that this is limited to. It is including, and there are other possibilities also as well. But the point would be to make sure that it's clear that it's not just monetary penalties, that there are other things that NERC and the commission have the power to do in addition to punitive fines.
So as long as there's a plausible argument that 215E does not authorize the imposition of monetary penalties against the government, you lose, I think, under pretty settled sovereign immunity law. So why isn't it plausible to read the statute in the way the government is, which is to say, you see a mention of the United States under 215B1, you just don't see it under 215E, either E1 or E3, And that's supplemented by the statute itself, because 201F tells us that unless you read, unless there's a specific mention of the United States or the other entities, they don't come within the fold of the provision. So that means that under 215E, the United States just isn't there. That's at least a plausible understanding. And so you're only left with 215B. And under 215B, you don't have to read it to encompass monetary penalties. You read it to encompass other things, because we know from the Supreme Court's decisions that monetary penalties raise extra sovereign immunity issues. So as long as you get the United States out from under 215E, it seems like you have a very difficult argument. There only has to be a plausible argument that they're not within 215E. So I'm taking 316A out of the equation altogether. Well, under 215E in particular, what's implausible about reading that statute to say the United States just isn't covered by it?
It's implausible, Your Honor, the Commission found, because it's implausible to read the statutes, the individual subsections of the statutes, separately without reference to each other. And the
doesn't
sovereign immunity
cases... Doesn't 201F tell us we have to do that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Doesn't 201F say we have to do that? Because it says for a provision, I think it speaks in terms of a provision, which I take it would be subsections, that unless the United States is mentioned in a provision, you assume that it's out. And so it is mentioned in the provision of E1. It's just not mentioned in the provision of E1 or E3.
Well, it actually says the provisions of section, right. And it includes Section 215 in its entirety. And I would note there are several sections of the statute that it refers to only to a particular subsection where the United States is referenced. But that's not true with respect to 215. It's the section in it, the provisions of Section 215. And 201B2 makes the link between conferring jurisdiction on the Commission over the federal entities and the enforcement provisions of the Act. And the reason why the Commission felt that you couldn't plausibly read E in the abstract without reference to B, and it goes back to all the sovereign immunity cases say you only apply the doctrine of sovereign immunity following applying the canons of the ordinary canons of construction. And one of the ordinary canons of construction is that you read the statute in its entirety. And it's implausible to look at enforcing compliance in subsection B as having no reference whatsoever to subsection E, which is enforcement. And it was simply an implausible reading of the statute when you're required to look at the statute as a whole and look at the statutory language in context to conclude
that those things are unrelated. If E wasn't in the statute at all and all you had was B, so there's no further explication in E, would you take the position that B just doesn't do anything? B1 just doesn't do anything? It gives the Commission no authority at all?
No, Your Honor, but what E does is clarify what Congress meant by enforcing. There would be debate, obviously, given what the petitioner's argument, there would be debate about what enforcing compliance means and what it authorizes the Commission to do. What Congress did in E is explain exactly what authority it was giving to the Commission and to the Electric Reliability Organization. And if you got rid of E, E is what gives the Electric Reliability Organization its power to impose penalties. And B is simply a reference to the Commission.
Right, but if you think B, absent E, would supply some power, then why that the addition of E doesn't seem to make it implausible to think that B still stands alone in certain respects. B also has stuff in it, undoubtedly, but you still look at B alone, and B is the only one that refers to the United States. Unless you think, if you thought that B didn't do anything on its own absent E, well, then you'd have to read E as the one that supplies the power to the exclusion of B. But once you acknowledge that B does supply power, then why doesn't the United States' argument seems more plausible, at least that it's plausible, to say that B says some things, E says something else. E doesn't have anything to do with the United States, so you just look to B.
But the problem from the Commission's interpretation was that E doesn't do something else. It explains what enforcing compliance is supposed to mean. It explains the scope of enforcement authority, and it references back to the people to whom that enforcement authority is to be applied, which is users, owners, and operators, including the federal government.
But why isn't, to further Judge Srinivasan's point, aren't B and D together enough to make clear? I mean, B says enforce compliance with this section. D are the reliability standards. So under B, the Commission can enforce, including against the United States reliability standards? Why do you need E to figure out what the commission can do?
Because E specifies, I mean, exactly the conversation we're having this morning. I mean, they say under B, the commission can impose non-monetary penalties but and non-monetary sanctions, but nothing else. Mm-hmm. And E adds clarity to that. It explains that the commission has expressed penalty authority.
Well, that's in C, that there's penalty authority there. I see, because it says in accordance with subsection E, so that's the reference.
Right, Your Honor, and that is in that.
Wouldn't you interpret the words enforce compliance to include, given your broad view of this, wouldn't you interpret the words enforce compliance to include penalties, particularly given that you have 316A, which gives the commission penalty authority? So I don't understand why the commission, I understand why ERO may need, the ERO may need something else, but why does the commission need E?
It just further explains the commission's authority, and it makes clear that that includes penalties as well as the kind of injunctive relief, and that it might be associated with compliance.
Isn't that at least clear from 316A that the commission has penalty civil penalty authority? Seems quite clear, doesn't it? Any person who violates any provisions of subchapter 2 or any provisions of any rule or order they're under shall be subject to a civil penalty. So it's clear that you didn't need E in order to have a civil penalty enforced by the commission.
You need E to have a civil penalty enforced by the commission with respect to 215, which applies to people who are not persons under 316A. That's the purpose of it. That's what makes it independent penalty authority, is that it applies to people, it applies to non-persons.
That assumes you want it to apply to non-persons. We're trying to figure out whether Congress wanted it to apply to non-persons or not.
Well, this is where I think, Your Honor, you should consider in West versus Gibson, one of the things that the Supreme Court looked at was whether or not, for purposes of determining what an appropriate interpretation of the statute was whether or not it would undermine the purposes of the statute. And here, the thing you have to bear in mind is what you were talking about is that the Electric Reliability Organization, which is charged with administering this reliability program, and the commission with respect to monetary penalties, all of a sudden has no authority whatsoever over people who are not persons. And you have to consider who that includes. It's not just the federal government. It's state governments, it's municipalities, which include cities and counties and irrigation districts. And, I mean, the scope, as the court said in the Bonneville case that the petitioners cite, the scope of the exclusion is enormous. Of who you're talking about is not subject at all to the Electric Reliability Organization jurisdiction, and is limited.
It's not that they're not subject. It's that they're not subject to civil penalties, monetary penalties.
Well, they said that that E doesn't apply to people who are not persons. And E is the enforcement authority of the Electric Reliability Organization.
Not all of those, I guess not all of those non-persons raise sovereign immunity issues. Certainly the states do. Their municipal districts may.
We're talking about persons, though, Your Honor. I mean, with respect to 316A, you're talking about who is or is not a person. And what you're saying is that someone who is not a person is not subject to the commission's civil penalty authority or to the Electric Reliability Organization's penalty authority under 215. And that's not an issue of sovereign immunity. That's just an issue of statutory definition.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Any time left? We'll give you another 2 minutes. I at least have a question. And it arises out of the last exchange.
Sure. Just a couple quick points.
No, before you make those quick points.
I just
want to know, what about municipal waste entities, et cetera? Are they persons or not persons?
Well, I think the definition of person includes an individual or corporation. Mm-hmm. So I guess there'd be a question about whether, for example, a municipal corporation is a corporation within the meaning of that term. I mean, in the Monell case, the Supreme Court said that a municipality was a person for purposes of 1983. It's an open question. The court doesn't need to decide. But more importantly, if the court found the definition of person in section 316A to be the decisive point, That point would apply only to the imposition of monetary penalties, which is what 316A, which is what 316A concerns. So I do think it would be a more limited point than what the commission just told you.
Can I ask you this question? So under E3, it tells you how the commission goes about imposing penalties, and it says that after notice and opportunity, it extends to when you're about to engage in a violation as opposed to a violation that's already occurred. Do you think that those apply to the imposition, those attributes of the commission's authority to impose penalties apply to the imposition of non-monetary penalties against the government under B1?
I mean, if it might, but it wouldn't by virtue of E3. I mean, it might by virtue of the commission's independent way it goes about exercising authority to impose non-monetary penalties under its general enforcement authorities under B1 and Part 3 of the Federal Power Act more generally, but it wouldn't be by virtue of E3.
So there's B1, there's just a separate architecture of procedures that are kind of apparent in the way that I'm not saying that's implausible. I'm just asking that's just inherent in the way that the commission conducts its affairs that would apply to B1 penalties.
Well, I think that's at least, yes, a plausible way to understand the statute. But, I mean, more generally, I mean, I think unlike the commission, we have a plausible story to tell about what E3 is doing. And namely, what E3 is doing, I think, most plausibly, it's just making clear that you wouldn't draw a negative inference from the fact that NERC has authority in this field. From the fact that the commission couldn't exercise parallel authority in this field. And that's why I think is a plausible explanation for why Congress created this parallel E1, E3 structure.
Well, E3 actually gives the commission more authority than ERO, I think, because it extends to not yet germinated violations. It extends to violations that are about to occur, and I didn't see that E1 did that. Or maybe I'm misreading.
Potentially. I mean, but I guess... Right. I mean, but it at least has some authority in this field, and I think that would be important to specify in light of the fact that some clever litigant might come in and say, no, commission, you can't do stuff in this field if you didn't have E3. But that doesn't mean that it's a freestanding grant of penalty of unlimited penalty, an unadorned authority to impose penalties free of the limits of 316A. And the Commission's position today about the applicability of the monetary cap is exactly contrary to the position it took in 2006 and in the order under review, in which I thought the Commission had reaffirmed its position that the monetary cap on 316A is fully applicable to penalties imposed under 215E.
Well, the argument they're making is that it is fully applicable, but that's as a matter of authority under the APA to interpret, right. And of course it makes sense to take into consideration other caps in other places, and so they're imposing it rather than that they are required by the statute to do it.
No, that's not the position they took, Your Honor. I'll quote.
No, I'm just saying that is the position they're taking now.
Right, and it's contrary to what they said in 2006.
Can you quote what they said?
And the quote in 2006 is, it said, quote, Section 316A establishes a limit on a monetary penalty for a violation of a reliability standard that may be imposed by the ERO, pursuant to FPA Section 215. And that's at 71 Federal Register 8711. And then, again, JA 30, it characterized that prior order as holding, quote, that the monetary cap set out in FPA Section 316A is applicable to FPA Section 215 penalties. It was not a matter of policy or enforcement discretion. And that interpretation that Section 316A provides a limit is at least reasonable, and therefore there cannot be a clear and unequivocal waiver of the sovereign immunity of the United States with regard to other matters specified in Section 316A, namely the entities that are subject to penalties.
Further questions from the panel? We'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.